Today's grown-ups have left the world in a mess. Can today's kids show us how to clean it up?
I start every game with an apology. I apologize to my students. And I play with elementary, high school, middle school, and even adults now in college. I apologize to them that we're playing this game because there is now a necessity to actually solve these problems that we're playing at. And I hope that this game can help them learn how to do that. I'm very sincere in my apology. I say, I'm very sorry, boys and girls. We adults have left you this problem in your world, and I hope you can help us to solve it.
That's teacher John Hunter. We talk with him about his inspiring world peace game that he's been teaching to kids for 30 years. His book is World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. And can green go wrong?
What we get if we continue to operate within this same economic logic that has the growth imperative embedded in it, driving it, then we will get what's happening in this situation, which is industrial food transforming what organic is instead of organic transforming what industrial food is, and instead of organic transforming our food system.
That's Heather Rogers. We talk with her about her book, Green Gone Wrong: How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
It's a game that makes you think really hard. It makes you really think about what's really going on in the world.
What I think is, you can't be all about war, and you can't be, again, this may sound bad, but you can't be all about peace.
Yeah, not like all like flowers and grassy fields and solar panels and
last
houses.
Year.
No, it's not like that. You'll have to have some defense.
It's challenging. There is no right or wrong answer. If you wanted a right answer, choose the one that helps everyone and then think about yourself.
Those are some voices from a fourth grade classroom taught by John Hunter. The game is the World Peace Game Hunter devised and has been teaching for over 30 years, first just in fourth grade classes and now up through high school and even the college level. You heard a clip from the film about Hunter and his game. It's called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. And now Hunter is out with a book of the same title. In World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, he shares inspiring stories from his years of teaching the World Peace game. His fourth graders eagerly take on the challenges that are stumping world leaders and arguably doing a better job, from nuclear proliferation to tribal warfare to global warming. They learn that collaboration works better than competition, but the lessons are hard won, not fed to them by their teacher. In his years of teaching the game, John Hunter's students have taught him many lessons about true wisdom and how truly listening to others brings surprising solutions to seemingly intractable problems. Well, John Hunter, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you, Francesca. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, I was just thrilled to find out about this book, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. In this case, it came after the movie, not before. Isn't that right?
That's right. In 2006, Chris Farina, an independent filmmaker, was introduced to me in my classroom by a mutual friend. And being an independent filmmaker, he said, I'd like to make a film, but I've got no money. So we bravely set upon that course anyway, not really intending to have anything come of it much, but as fate would have it, Chris's film was received widely at South by Southwest at the Bergen International Film Festival, and has since been seen all over the world. And following that, a TED Talk came up and many other things, but that really led to the book, actually, and an agent in Manhattan got in touch with me, and we put it together in about a year and a half or so.
Well, it is just absolutely wonderful to read and very inspiring. The World Peace Game, you've been doing this for about 35 years. Tell us, how did it start? I mean, first of all, why did you even conceive it, and then how did it get going?
Well, you know, I had spent quite a bit of time dropping out of college and traveling all over the world, and mostly in Asia, and had really gotten, inspired and influenced by the teachings of Gandhi and other Eastern teachers about the concept of ahimsa, or nonviolence. And coming back into my first teaching job when I finally did graduate from school, in Richmond Public Schools in Virginia. I was not given a mandate or directions or any kind of manual to follow whatsoever for teaching gifted inner-city minority high school kids my first job. The supervisor actually asked me what did I want to do, which really kind of upset me because I was expecting to be told what to do and how to teach well. But they really opened the door and said, that I would have to create the path. And I think that actually became a template for the way I teach, we have taught for my entire career. The game came out of really not having any direction. I had learned from my undergraduate mentors, particularly Miss Ethel J. Banks in Richmond, who said, just love the students, find out what they love and what they care about, and build curriculum to and around that. That passion will drive any curriculum you want to try and teach them. And so she was right. In 1978, their passion was board games. We didn't have Twitter. We had no Facebook. We had a desert of media back then. So we used board games, and I had to teach a unit in African studies, social studies in Africa. And so I combined the two, and then I used problem-solving skills, which were sort of in vogue at the time, and sort of did a mashup of all that, and that became the first world peace game, really. And it's evolved dramatically since then, over three decades.
And you say problem-solving skills, and that you were given a problem to solve, too. I found it lovely where you talk about your mom, who was also a teacher. I mean, you basically learned problem-solving from her way. And your father also had a similar way of working with you. I don't know if you're an only child, but you and your siblings, if you had them. Tell us about that space of silence, that space of openness.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I have a brother, Malcolm, and we both really came up under the same system, you might say. We were raised in the 60s, and the late 50s and 60s, with our parents. My mother, a very quiet, very loving, very deeply reflective woman. My father, a very advanced, expansive thinker, creative and inventive thinker, spatial thinker. And together, they just sort of, their lifestyle created a huge space for us as kids. And we would ask a question, what is the answer, or what should we do? And they would always reflect it back to us. You know, what do you think you should do? Think deeply about it, then come and tell me what you think. So that was really our way of being as a family. And, of course, at the time, we were under segregation, and that did change during my childhood. But I remember we had to be, of course, very careful. We were trained to be very careful in the community and not to be too obvious or too outside the box of conventional behavior for African Americans at the time, to be safe, really. So that kind of quiet, reflective approach to things didn't mean we were inactive. My parents actually were very active under the surface. They would, behind the scenes, be engineering all kinds of social changes, but very quietly, so that it appeared it was invisible work, really. And that approach really influenced me as a teacher, that I can provide a reflective, quiet environment for my students to be absorbed in and to discover their own solutions while being very active in a very quiet and almost invisible way as a teacher, to allow and facilitate that kind of learning and thinking. So that's really how I came to that kind of approach to things, and it really meshed beautifully with, you know, the Eastern approaches I learned in Zen monasteries and in Indian ashrams, this sort of inner quietude that we look at, and also the kind of self-reflective experiments or exploration we have of looking into our own selves, our own hearts, and clearing away, you know, I guess, inhibitions, or clearing away problems and difficulties and flaws and faults, so that we can provide a better presentation with the world, better interaction with the world, with less difficulties that are very subtle within us. So I think my parents were a great model for that, really.
Hmm. And now in this game, the World Peace Game, it's amazingly complex. I mean, you have the children solve 50 interconnected crises, which is, you know, just unbelievable. Lay out for our listeners, you know, the structure of the game. How does it work? And then we'll give examples, because I think it really comes alive with the examples. But first, just tell us the basic construction.
Sure. It's a geopolitical simulation that involves basically four fictional countries. They're arranged around a structure. The structure is a 4-foot by 4-foot by 4-foot plexiglass tower. It's basically four horizontal layers of 4-foot by 4-foot quarter-inch plexiglass sheeting that are stacked vertically above each other with space between, emulating our Earth. You have an undersea level with submarines, undersea mining, sunken civilizations, reefs, and so forth. You have a ground and sea level with, of course, mountains and valleys and rivers and cities and towns and oceans and armies and navies and factories and cities, just as we have here. There's an aircraft level just at about my 9-year-old fourth grader's eye level, and that's a sheet of plexiglass where you see territorial airspaces outlined and huge puffs of cotton for clouds that are pushed around by our weather goddess who controls the random events and random stock market, and also air forces. And the top level, which is above their heads and the fourth graders, is an outer space level. We have a space station, all kinds of satellites, research, and killer satellites as well, black hole, asteroid mining, all sorts of stars and star structures. And so this entire structure is sort of a pretext for really the students are tackling 50 interlocking global problems that are sort of ripped from the headlines, really. They're real-world problems, and they're modified for children just a bit, but they're asked to solve them all without combat if possible. They read Sun Tzu's The Art of War in order to do that. The four countries each have have a cabinet, prime minister, secretary of state, minister of defense, and a CFO. There's a World Bank, United Nations body, and even a group of arms dealers. And I think the really great aspect is we have a saboteur. And it's sometimes a child you'll find getting in all kinds of trouble. I think that child's being very creative, and I use that skill set. I ask that child to become our saboteur, and basically, while trying to solve all the problems of the world and raise every country's asset value, our two goals in the game, to secretly, through misinformation and misdirection and ambiguities, try to destroy the entire game. We all know that person's in the room. We don't know who it is. So everyone must think more deeply about everything that is said by everyone, including your best friend. And so that's the game. It usually takes about 8 weeks to play. And over the last 35 years, they have won the game and saved the world countless times.
Now, about the saboteur, you didn't have him or her in the beginning. Tell us a little bit more about this, because I found it a very interesting idea. First of all, why you invented the saboteur, and then also what the impact is on the saboteur as well as on everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Well, the saboteur, you know, the children can refuse me. That's one rule I have in my classroom. If I ask you to do something, you can say no. You can offer an alternative way. So I'm very careful in that selection who that child can be. It has to be a very high-functioning child who can deal at that level and manage himself so well. And so not every child wants to do that, but there's some that really do. And I try to find the best match. And that child heartily, happily takes on the role. And at the end of the game, amazingly, they're always celebrated by every student in the room because the students are so thrilled. They said, "You made it harder for us," they tell the saboteur. "You made it more challenging and more fun. Thank you." And they're so excited when they find out who the saboteur is, and so surprised usually, too. So that effect was not in the game early on because students seemed to have enough difficulty just dealing with all the crises. But at some point, they became, I guess, a little weary of warfare, and they said, "Let's just all sign a peace treaty." At the beginning, they would say this, "Let's just lay down arms and sign a peace treaty. Let's just not fight." And it became a little too easy. So I had to sort of ramp up the challenge again by putting in elements that really emulate life. We never know from minute to minute what is going to happen. We like to think we do, we hope we do, but life is such a vast unknown that I wanted the children to be able to grapple with that reality without being frightened and to deal with that vastness of existence in a positive way and be excited about taking on that challenge. So I figured that from within their ranks, the challenge should come from within themselves, really. It's a human aspect of us that we have this saboteur element within all of us, actually. So they're working with and against themselves at the same time, trying to become more or better than human and the best humans they can be. Hmm. Realizing that there is a negative side as well, and working with that rather than trying to ignore it or shut it out.
We're talking with John Hunter about his book, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. It's about a game that he has been teaching fourth and fifth graders for the last 35 years, in which they solve 50 interconnected world problems. Now, one of the saboteurs you talk about in the book is Rodney. Tell us about him and his experience.
Well, I believe Rodney was a fellow who was sort of a self-appointed saboteur, really. He wasn't my official choice, but he had a way of his... His style was to basically be a very sneaky and underhanded fellow.
Right.
I think he thought it was to his advantage, and he would try to get over on others. And he was very good at it, really. And he manipulated so many situations. And finally, in the game, he ran into a situation where he could not manipulate. He was sort of seen as an emperor without any clothes, and that was his sort of crash-and-burn moment. And his despair was so intense, and I did not have an answer for that. I did not know what to do as a teacher. Experienced teacher that I was, you know, you can't know the answer to every child's situation, but I put my best intention forward and put compassion forward and just sat with him and asked him what he thought he might do. Of course, he didn't have an answer for quite a while. And finally, he saw some glimmer of hope in that maybe working with others rather than against them might be a way. I didn't suggest that to him. He came up with that himself. And he moved forward. Of course, he approached the strongest person in the game. I think it was Tiffany, who was our UN Secretary General, to ally forces with her. And she, of course, saw right through him and invited him to participate, but with the caveat that he had to admit his shortcomings and admit his behavior and change it. And I think he did so under her direction. She was a very strong young woman. But that particular kind of behavior that would sabotage things, of its own accord, Rodney saw the limitations of that and decided to come in from the cold, so to speak.
I wonder why he did seem like a saboteur type, and somehow I just... you know, I put him in there, but yeah, it's a very poignant moment in the book when he realizes that his old ways don't work and the newer ones do. What have you seen in terms of the children? I mean, of course, it's over 35 years, you've seen many different things, but what are some of the most common impacts you see in how they change, what they learn?
Oh, that's a great question, Francesca, and that's what really warms the heart of a teacher, you know, that there may really be some long-term effect. The very next year, 2007, right after Chris Farina's film, documentary World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, was finished, one of the girls, Amelia, she's the very fiery prime minister in the game, in the film, she read about in fifth grade social studies a country, I think Mozambique it was, where a village was having difficulty getting clean water, and people were dying from waterborne diseases. They didn't have access to clean water. And she also read that it took $100 to put a well in that village to help solve that problem, but no one had done it. So she got quite upset and immediately organized a charity among her peers, her classmates, and collected pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters, and put together a $100 donation, asked an adult teacher to facilitate the transfer, and followed it through to make sure a well was put in that village, and actually lives were saved. She had had water rights difficulties as a prime minister herself in the game, and really sympathized and had a larger, deeper understanding of what those people were going through in the real world, and just decided to apply what she'd learned in a perfect opportunity in the real world. We've had a number of students who, you know, decades later, 10, 20, 30 years later, who write me or get in touch with me through email and say, Mr. Hunter, this game put me into international educational reform policy in D.C., or this game put me into war and peace studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill and international diplomacy issues, and I'm stellar at it because I've been doing diplomacy since I was 9 years old. You know, that kind of heartwarming feeling. And those letters are on our website, too. It's pretty amazing to go back and read them from people who say they've been affected by what you've done as a teacher. And for a teacher, I think that's the most heartwarming thing. You know, it's bittersweet. A student leaves your room, you don't know, you may never see them again. You don't maybe even know what happens to them. And you wonder, you lay awake at night seeing their faces go by, and you wonder what happened to this one or to that one. So when they write back or they come back and let you know that not only have they not only are they all right, but they made something of themselves, and perhaps you had a hand in it. Oh, you know, for a teacher, that is the pinnacle, really.
Yeah. And so Amelia had problems with water rights also. Give us a sense of how some of these crises interconnect. I mean, give us an example, maybe that one. What was she dealing with? There were two prime ministers, David and Amelia. Give us a sense of what happened there.
Well, in that particular instance, those two prime ministers were at odds because through a loophole in an agreement that Amelia had made, she had ceded away some of her territory to the other prime minister's country, and she didn't realize it legalistically until too late. So they were at really difficult odds with each other, and the UN was called in to mediate the situation. But Amelia's water right difficulties, I think, stem from the desert country next door having a military campaign and having a water conduit system from their lakes in one end of the country through the desert to their troops in the field at the other end of the country. And that water line was severed. And they understood from that, it was severed through a military attack, I believe, that without water, the troops in the field cannot fight. And so the hostilities ground to a halt because of that strategic move by someone. And, of course, there was an aquifer problem connected with that because of the two countries were pumping water from the same aquifer underneath their land, and two sets of farmers, one in each country, were about to go to war with each other because they couldn't get enough of the water from the aquifer. But if they all kept pumping at the same rate, they all were going to run out of water. And there were a lot of third parties involved, some tribal groups. So it really was a chaotic mess, and I designed it that way. And it only got worse at first, because the game is designed to fail massively at first. Everyone is going to go into a state of despair. There's no way around it. I've designed it that way. And only our relationship between the students and myself and the students keeps us afloat through that low period that I know they're going to go through until they discover how to be collaborative and how to come out of that. I don't teach collaboration. They discover it and employ it themselves. It's their own learning that propels their solutions and their way out of difficulties. So I think that's what happened to Amelia. She was embroiled in a number of crises at once and had to, you know, put aside some emotional feelings to really deal with this thing pragmatically.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these crises also involve, or at least maybe those are the ones I pick up on the most because it's a overriding concern of mine, are ecological crises. I mean, you show the interconnection between ecology and economy in war. Give us an example of that. There's one chapter of Gunther Sloan's Global Warming. I mean, this is something these kids are going to have to deal with. We're already dealing with it now. It's just going to get worse. Yeah.
That's right. And I start every game with an apology. I apologize to my students. And I play with elementary, high school, middle school, and even adults now in college. I apologize to them that we're playing this game because there is now a necessity to actually solve these problems that we're playing at. And I hope that this game can help them learn how to do that. I'm very sincere in my apology. I say I'm very sorry, boys and girls. We adults have left you this problem in your world, and I hope you can help us to solve it. So we start with that, and then I develop the problems. I design them according to a formula that sort of struck me late one night, that the problems all have to be interrelated and interconnected as things are in life. This game emulates the way life really is. There's no isolated problem, really. It may appear to be at first, and the students attack things that way at first, but they quickly learn that there are layers to things, and appearances are never what they seem to be, as my father would often say, and that there are multiple layers of consequence to everything. And so one crisis might be a very poor, ice-locked country facing famine has suddenly made a discovery of an oil deposit on their land on one of their offshore islands, and they're eager to drill this and collect revenue to save their people. But the country next door is an ecologically minded country, very dedicated to protecting the earth and all of its life forms. And they have an army and navy and air force, which some people say it's kind of like hippies with tanks, you know, but their job is to protect the environment. So they immediately send their navy and surround that island that actually belongs to the poor country. They sort of invaded their territorial waters, which is a declaration of war in the game's view, and said, no, you will not drill because you will kill an endangered species that happens to be on that very site where you want to drill. If you drill, they will die. It's a real conundrum. But then simultaneously, a third country, a very wealthy country, offers to buy that land from the poor country with immediate cash. You know, no problem. We'll take care of it. And then, meanwhile, a fourth country says that it has discovered a document with a smudged signature on it, by the way, that says that the land actually belongs to them. They're way over on the other side of the world, and they say no one can do anything until they come in. And the United Nations is asked to come in and sort this out. I mean, there's no hard and fast right answer, which is the beauty of the game. There are no particular right answers. Students have to come to an understanding of what is right themselves and apply it and see if it works. And if it doesn't, they learn failure. And in this game teaches success and failure, and they learn how to deal with failure. As we have it in real life, we try to pretend it doesn't exist or avoid it wherever possible. Sure, but this game actually allows them to go through that experience and learn how to deal with life when it doesn't look like what we want it to look like, and learn how to master that situation as well. So that's one of our typical scenarios. It's kind of interlocking.
It seems like an incredibly sophisticated game, and you did start out teaching gifted and talented kids. Can every level of classroom play this game?
Well, you know, I think fourth grade is the lowest academic level, 9 years old, mm-hmm. that can actually handle it. I've tried third graders. It's a little bit beyond them. Right. And I know adults have done it as well. I'm sorry, you had a question there?
Well, I just meant not so much the grade level itself, but, you know, is it just for gifted and talented, or do you think that...
Well, now we're playing the game all over the world, and I'm playing with students that I've never met before. I have to have a few hours or something to establish a relationship, because the game is based on relationships. You can't have it without that. So I'm playing with kids from Pakistan and Germany and Sweden all in one room, and they've never met before here in the U.S. or wherever. And in a few hours, they've got to develop a relationship and put together a team that can actually deal with these problems with a saboteur in their midst. And so what I ask in the application that students make to play the game is that they consider deeply with their parents and their teachers whether they have enough intellectual stamina mm-hmm. to be able to go through this very frustrating experience, because there are no right answers. The answers are not going to come quickly. No matter how smart you are, you cannot solve them by yourself. And you've got to be able to put off closure. You've got to be able to forestall closure and deal with people who disagree with you for extended periods of time. And that's right for pretty much anybody. I wouldn't say giftedness is a marker that could be handled. But, you know, the definition of giftedness has changed over the decades I've been teaching now, with the work of Carol Tomlinson at the University of Virginia and Joe Renzulli at the University of Connecticut, who now have opened up that definition to say something like anyone could exhibit gifted behaviors at any time under any circumstance. Hmm. And so we never really know. We've got to allow access to most everybody to try those high-level kinds of skills and offerings. And now the gifted program, of course, has expanded out into classrooms. So we've got a sort of porous barrier now between what we call regular school and gifted programs. Kids come in and out of my room all the time, and they may or may not be identified gifted, and they've been quite successful at playing the game.
Well, I mean, it just shows in your book, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, John Hunter, you really show that if you challenge kids, if you treat them, you know, with respect, that they can do something that, you know, most classrooms would never imagine.
That's right. Oh, you're so right, Francesca. You know, we have we forget as adults how wonderful and how brilliant and how wise we were as children, really. And they're an underutilized resource in a way. Because when I come into a classroom, yeah, I'm given a mandate, perhaps, these days, we must teach this or we need to look into this area and so forth. And so I say to the students when we meet our first lesson, I say, boys and girls, here's what they say we have to do. Here's what we have to learn and cover and explore this year, this semester. And then I stop and say, how shall we do that? What do you think? And we brainstorm for a half an hour. And basically, I'm trying to engage their interests, their passions, in the course of discovering the curriculum. And then I ask, after they finish that, and they're a bit excited and stunned that they've been asked to participate in the creation level of this activity, I ask them, how can everything go wrong? Let's brainstorm how everything can fail. We might not get it all, but let's just take a shot at it. And that opens another door into their thinking completely. And by the time we've done that introductory session, they're so jazzed, so excited, so amazed that an adult has asked them to be empowered in their own learning, that they're going to become co-teachers with me in the classroom. I've got 30 co-teachers in my room, so everything doesn't have to come out of my head. You know, there are wise people that happen to be half my height standing all around me, so why not utilize that resource, ask them and invite them into the process of being in charge of their own learning. And they're so much more excited by that. I think being someone, they even help develop the assessment we use. You know, so they can say, here's how I did, and here's how I know how I did, and here's how I know what I learned, and let me demonstrate it. And the assessments they build show these things. Their parents are much more pleased with that than just a typical letter grade. It's so much more informative to have those kind of child-led assessments.
John Hunter. He's the author of World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements and the subject of a film of the same name. We'll talk more after a break. Stick around.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with teacher John Hunter about his World Peace Game, a role-playing game he's been using in classrooms for over 30 years, challenging fourth and fifth graders to solve real-world problems like climate change, nuclear proliferation, and war. His book and a movie about the game is World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. Just before the break, Hunter was describing how he involves his students in assessing their own educational needs and accomplishments. It struck me as very similar to the popular education model developed by Brazilian educator Paulo Freire and practiced by the Highlander Center in Tennessee. It reminds me of the popular education model that was taught by the Highlander School, which was teaching folks who were poor in many cases, had very little education, but really exactly taking that framework that you are the experts, the teacher is the facilitator.
Right, we're the facilitator. We certainly are not experts in everything, and that's also an admission I make to the students in our first meeting. The boys and girls, I don't know the answer to everything, and I may not even know the answers to a lot of your questions here in this class about this subject. But we're all going to have to become researchers, and I think one thing that brings about is there's a compassion that rises up. You know, they think, oh, poor Mr. Hunter, he doesn't really know the answers. We've got to help him. You know, we've got to help that man. And they want to help me out and show their own wisdom and knowledge, and so they get excited about doing research. Mm-hmm. They give themselves homework, because they want to come in and be helpful in the class and help out this man up front who admits he doesn't know all the answers.
Oh, that's wonderful. They actually give themselves homework.
Yes, they do. Oh, it's astounding. We had students who, in the World Peace Game, ask, because their uncle was the hydrologist and involved in fracking in Canada, if we had fracking in the game. And I said, no, we don't. Should we? And she immediately went home and did homework, came back in the next day and did a 4-minute exposition on every aspect of the geology involving hydraulic research and fracking, developed a policy that we should have it in the game, and convinced everyone else, and the weather goddess got involved. We worked out how that's going to play out in our rules and assign values to everything, and now that's a part of our game, because a student gave herself homework and decided to make a difference in the whole structure and was allowed to.
Now, You have to teach to the test like so many millions of other teachers. It's such a diametrically opposed form of teaching, the whole, accountability, no child left behind, race to the top kind of a thing. Talk about these two different approaches and, you know, why... I think there's been a lot of criticism of teaching to the test, and how do you integrate these two, and what's your perspective on that?
Well, you know, being in a large public school, 560 kids last year, 23 different languages and ethnic groups, and over 50% free and reduced lunch, or kids in poverty to some extent, I've had to be a part of that testing practice. I've had to proctor and administer tests and so forth. I'm not directly responsible for a classroom, fortunately for me, but I have had to be, of course, a part of that. And I would just point to the example that great visionary, trusting and caring leaders do in situations like that. My principal now, Michelle Kastner, does this amazing thing every year. It's astounding to me. It shows trust on a very human level in such a demanding, pressured situation. We'll look at our mid-year test scores for our school. All the teachers gather in one room. We look at the PowerPoints. We put up all the scores. And they're often not stellar. You know, there's some concern here and there. And we're all kind of worried. But then our principal, I mean, she's a very glamorous individual anyway, but she gets up very charismatic and says, she gives about a two-minute speech. She says, "I know you all. I trust you all. I've hired you. I've handpicked each one of you for this job. You are professionals. You know what to do. I will support you in any way possible and help you. Do what you know is best for these children through this testing period, and I know everything will be all right." And then she walks out of the room. It's an astounding moment. I mean, we're just stunned and thrilled at the same time. And every year after that, every year, the test scores go up, in some cases through the roof. A couple of years ago, I remember 100% of our fifth grade African-American males scored passing or advanced passing in mathematics, which was unheard of. Mm-hmm. And so, I remember the teacher was asked what method she used. What is the key? How did you succeed in this? What is your skill set that allows it to happen? And she said, "There is no method. We just work together. We have a relationship. And we have a trusting relationship that makes it possible." And so in a school where you have visionary and trusting and caring leadership, where as a teacher you can turn your back on your principal and teach and not be afraid and not worry if your professional teaching is not good enough. If you're a good professional, you know what to do. When you have that kind of trust and trusting environment, you know, the support of not only your colleagues and the administration, but the custodians, the secretaries, the TAs, the bus drivers, the cooks, and the nurse, you know, it's an entire organism. It takes every aspect, every person to make that possible. When you have that kind of environment, you're almost bound to succeed because the testing policies come and go. They're like weather. You know, sometimes it's hard, heavy weather, and you put on a heavy coat and get through it as best you can. Other times the sun's out. But despite the weather changes, we're all professionals, and we simply know that the basis of every success really is a relationship between the teacher and the student. And that's our bottom line.
And that's very much also at the center of the World Peace Game is relationships. And yet, the two different approaches are quite different. One open problem solving, the other there's only one right answer. Which do you think is more valuable to the students as they go out in the world?
That's a tricky question, isn't it?
I know that was.
Well, you know, I'm going to say that they're complementary. I'm going to say that what we do in the World Peace Game, where there's a complete infinite range of possibilities and you've got to decide what is the best one, really mirrors or resonates with a testing situation where there's only one right answer and you've got to find that best one. I might not think that's the best way of learning, that kind of testing situation where you bubble in the correct answer. I might not think that's the best way of learning for every situation. But if that is the landscape, then we will learn how to navigate and we will be great explorers in that landscape. We will manage it because our skills in the World Peace Game allow us and give us confidence to deal with any situation, even that situation.
Well, so finally, just, you know, the minute we may have left, What to you has been the most important learning for your life, for your way of being in the world, of doing this game?
From the game and from the students. Oh, wow. Well, I think a two-part experience has come for me. One is I've learned from the game and from the students that the key to our relationships working well and the game working well and success academically starts with a sort of self-reflective assessment, that it's a continual, daily, rigorous examination on a granular level of my own faults and flaws and prejudices and biases and subtle things, that barriers that get in the way of children learning, and of my own self being a better person, and to rigorously every day make an effort to weed those things out. You know, I think in America we call self-reflection a very lightweight, superficial kind of thing. We think, well, I like Rocky Road ice cream and Justin Bieber and Nine Inch Nails, and I love, you know, walks on the beach at sunset, and that's pretty much who I am, and that's our self-reflection. But I think self-reflection really has to go much deeper and be more extensive throughout our entire lives. So that's the first part of what I've learned. And the second part, the children really have shown me, illustrated it graphically every time we play. And that is that the core value, the core purpose of education, of teaching, of learning, is compassion, is to learn how to engage and develop active compassion for others and decrease suffering in the world. You know, we may be brilliant and very smart and have great amount of knowledge and skill at creating things and being good at business in the world. But, you know, one of my students even said to me, when I'm dead, and this is a very profound thing from a 9-year-old, when I'm dead, I don't want them to say I was just smart, because a lot of people are smart. They said, I want them to know I was really, really kind, because they'll never forget that, because, you know, I might be the kindest one. I know, what a profound thing for someone to say. So they've taught me that compassion really is my purpose in working with them. You know, over the long assessment, the real assessment is over 20, 30, 40 years. It's not a test or a semester or a year even. It's over years. And when students come back to me 20, 30 years later and say, Mr. Hunter, this is what kind of person I am, and I owe it to this World Peace Game experience, then I say that's the real assessment. And I can see how they've really grown over time.
Well, your work in this book, in World Peace and the World Peace Game, goes a long way to showing all of us how we can also do that. And I want to thank you so much, John Hunter, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you, Francesca. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You can watch the trailer for the movie about the World Peace Game by going to writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
One of the things I learned was that other people matter. In this game, one person can't win. Everyone has to win. And I think that taught me a lot about cooperating with other people, being generous, and having an attitude that if you work together, you can achieve anything.
In view of all the crises being solved, and in view of everyone's asset value being over 100 billion, I hereby declare this World Peace Game won!
Like me, I'll bet many of you do your best to buy green products when you can, to buy organic food, and hope by our consumer choices to make our impact on the planet lighter and more sustainable. But what if, let's say, your fair trade organic sugar from Whole Foods is sourced from a monopolistic sugar enterprise that squeezes the farmers it buys the sugar from and cuts down pristine rainforest for sugar plantations? Green is good, except when it isn't. I interviewed my guest, Heather Rogers, back in 2010 about her book, Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. I wrote a review of her book, but somehow never found the time to put the audio interview on this program. Today, we'll hear a short excerpt from that interview, and I'll follow up with the rest of it later on in the season. Heather Rogers' first book was Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. I started out by asking her how she went from thinking about garbage and the paths it takes to thinking about problems with the Green Revolution.
The argument in Gone Tomorrow is ultimately, you know, where I ended up after all the research and reporting that I did for that, was that we have an economy that is fundamentally based on the need for ever-expanding consumption, production, and wasting. And if we continue to have an economy with that kind of logic, we're going to continue to have ever-increasing amounts of garbage and the environmental impacts of that. And so I would go around and do talks for this book. I went all over the United States. I went to the UK. I went to Canada. And almost everywhere I went, at least somebody in the audience would say, you know, yeah, but if we just buy the right products, won't everything be okay? If we just drive hybrid cars and eat organic food and offset our carbon emissions. And so in many ways, this book was a response to that that thinking and those ideas. And this book is an effort to sort of unpack that and ask some deeper questions.
There was a brief period when biofuels were seen as the answer, and in fact, they're still being heavily invested in. And then there were food riots that happened. This was in 2007. This was maybe the first time some people started thinking about green going wrong. Tell us what happened there.
Well, 2007, the price of corn went up in 1 year by 80%. And it created a crisis that sort of first started in Mexico, and it was called the tortilla riots because corn is such a staple in Mexico, which they used to make tortillas. And a lot of regular people, working people, couldn't afford to buy tortillas and other foodstuffs. And that rippled across the world, the impacts of sending more crops to fuel refineries instead of to food processing plants. Created this situation. Often the way that we think about it, you know, there were food riots in over 30 countries, almost 40 countries. Sometimes they were deadly. The president of Haiti was ousted. You know, there was a lot of very serious political impacts and social distress, in addition to people not being able to access the food that they needed to live. So we often think about it in terms of this food crisis, in terms of people lacked access to food because we were a popular sort of slogan at the time was we're feeding our cars, not our people. And it's a little misleading because what was happening at the time was at that point, the economy hadn't collapsed yet, and there was a lot of commodity speculation going on. So it was this kind of perfect storm of increasing crops going into biofuel refineries. Biofuel refineries could pay more for those crops than food processors could. And in reality, what was going on was not a shortage of food, it was a shortage of money to buy it. Mm-hmm. And in developing countries, people spend 3/4 of their income, you know, it's very regular for that to happen, that people spend 3/4 of their income on food. So when the price goes up, even by 20%, it's a crisis. And when it goes up by as much as it did in 2007, 2008, it's something that is just not tenable. But it isn't just that we were sending the grains and the staple crops to refineries. There's other pieces to the picture. And when you just look at it from the perspective of biofuels use up food crops, it's very easy for the oil industry to come in and say, well, look, you know, fossil fuels are better. Mm-hmm.
In the book Green Gone Wrong, Heather Rogers points out that organic doesn't always mean sustainable or responsible. She writes about a sugar plantation in Paraguay from which Whole Foods Market sources its organic sugar.
It's a plantation called Azucarera Paraguaya, and it produces about 1/3 of all the organic sugar consumed in the United States. So it's a major player in the food system here. They sell to General Mills, they sell to White Wave, which makes Silk soy milk. They sell their sugar packaged under the name Wholesome Sweeteners in Whole Foods and other natural food grocery stores. And Wholesome Sweeteners is the importer, and Wholesome Sweeteners is owned by Imperial Sugar, which is the country's largest sugar maker and has a very dubious past and present. This plantation is, you know, the demand for organic has gone up by double digits every year since the mid-1990s. It's booming. And companies like Azucarera Paraguaya and General Mills and White Wave are doing their best to take advantage of the market. And according to the logic of sort of green capitalism, that's a good thing, because the more organic food, the more, you know, green products consumers demand, the more that demand will transform the supply chain, and that will turn our economy from a dirty one into a clean one. But this is an example of how that logic, while it sounds very neat and like it would maybe work, it starts to break down, and you start to see things like what I found in Paraguay. In order to meet this booming market demand, they have all of this incentive to make more organic sugar. What they're doing is they're expanding their cropland onto land that has been deforested from the Upper Paraná Atlantic Forest, which is one of the most biodiverse forests on the planet. It's one that you've never heard of, but it's one of the most biodiverse places, and therefore environmentally very valuable. And so when you buy the sugar, it looks good, it's organic, has the seal, it has the Fair Trade logo, but in reality it's being grown on land that's been deforested, and that's not what we have in mind when we look for those labels. And just to sort of tie it back in, what we get if we continue to operate within this same economic logic that must, you know, that has the growth imperative embedded in it, driving it, then we will get what's happening in this situation, which is industrial food transforming what organic is instead of organic transforming what industrial food is, and instead of organic transforming our food system.
We're talking with Heather Rogers about her book, Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. When you went and visited this sugar plantation in Paraguay, what did you find there on the ground here, that is, in terms of the people who lived in this area, the workers on the plantation, as well as the people who had lived around the forest that now was deforested?
Well, I primarily spent time with farmers who the plantation grows many of its own crops, and then the mill is expanding, so they need to augment their supplies from small farmers in the region, from campesino farmers. So I spent some time with some of these farmers who sell their cane, and they're, you know, they have farms that are, you know, 2 acres, 5 acres, 10 acres. They're small farms, and they're peasant farmers whose families have been there farming for generations and generations, and they don't have running water, and they live, you know, all the family members share one room, and, you know, these very small places, they have, you know, they don't have transportation. They've been increasingly buying cheap motorcycles on installment plans, so they're starting to be able to get around, but they don't have the transportation they need to get their crops to the mill. So they end up, they're sort of at the mercy of the mill. The mill calls for sugar cane when it needs it, and if these guys aren't ready, they miss the window. And they rely on a company owned by the same sugar mill, Azucarera Paraguaya. Members of that, the owners of the family, that the families that own that company also own the carting business. So it ends up being this very factory town type of deal. And the farmers that I met, what had happened that year was that the carters, the haulers, didn't show up. And so one of the farmers that I met didn't earn any money from his crops that year. Now, he's registered fair trade and organic. And just because a farmer is registered, you know, it just conjures all these ideas for us when we're standing in Whole Foods with our packaged whatever, cereal or whatever, that these, you know, we're really doing something for these people. If these farmers, they're tied to Azucarera Paraguaya, because if they want to sell as fair trade and organic, they have to have those seals, they have to have that certification, but they can't afford to get it. They can't afford to pay inspectors to come and verify their operations. So they form groups, and Azucarera Paraguaya, and this isn't unique to the situation, the mill, or, you know, the sort of entity that the farmers sell to, it might be some kind of co-op or other processing plant, they're the ones who pay for the certification. And in exchange for that, the farmers can only sell to that company, or they can only sell as organic to that company. Even though they grow organically, they can't sell organic to other refiners, and they can't sell as fair trade. So it becomes, in a way, a burden on these farmers instead of something that improves their livelihood. It becomes a tether to this single buyer, and it can really have adverse effects.
So you're saying you have this monopolization of the sugar industry in this area, of the organic so-called fair trade industry, that the certification itself is really expensive. How much would it be for a farmer?
Well, it would be their single largest fixed cost for these farmers if they had to pay for it. And I, you know, wasn't able to find out exactly how much these farmers would have to pay, but they don't have that kind of money sitting around. They earn typically lower than minimum wage for their entire year's crops, and that's it.
So how is this fair trade, and why? I mean, fair trade is supposed to be a certification process. Somebody is supposed to be minding whoever has the fair trade certification. How is it that this one company can control the process in such a way that, frankly, seems to me fraudulent?
Right. I've talked to people who, there's a woman named Laura Reynolds who is in Colorado. She's an academic and she researches fair trade. And I told her what I found and she said, that's not how it's supposed to work. But it does, because again, it's situated within. When I looked at the fair trade question more closely, I found that the Fair Trade Labeling Organization, which is the international oversight body for fair trade, they even say only 20% of fair trade crops are sold at fair trade prices. Most of the crops that are grown are either not, don't get sold at all, or are sold at conventional rates. And there's other aspects of fair trade that, you know, I talk about fair trade in the book, but there's a lot more to the story that I don't even get into. And one of the things is that the money from fair trade, I was surprised to find this out, the money from fair trade doesn't go directly to the farmers. It goes into a sort of pool that goes into, you know, building wells in the villages where they live or things like that. And in a way, you know, it just gets very tricky. It's sort of, there's this aspect of kind of social control or social, you know, it's just a sort of monitoring of what happens with that money. Because if you just give it to them, they might buy television sets or, you know, something that we don't want them to do. Or, you know, it's just very, it's just fraught. It's a fraught system. And it's the thing about it is that it's trying to work within the logic of a system that relies on extracting resources and you know, exploiting labor. And if we continue to let that system go unquestioned on a deeper level, then we're going to continue to have these kinds of conundrums and you know, contradictions.
That was Heather Rogers. I spoke with her in 2010 about her book, Green Gone Wrong. We'll air more from that interview in the coming months. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.